Welcome to Faith Uncut, a podcast where we explore faith in ways that might get you kicked out of most churches. I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
This week, we are discussing polytheism in the Bible.
Dun, 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 dun.
There's a lot of other gods in your Holy Bible that you're reading. So how do we get to this idea of monotheism where God is only God and that's it? It's just God and no other gods and nothing else exists.
Mm-hmm.
It's a funny thing. When you read the Bible, you see pantheon of gods.
Yes. I mean, but how else are you going to demonstrate that your God is better than all of those other gods?
There's no competition. Yeah.
Exactly.
All right, so
let's dive in.
This is kind of an idea that I've always wondered about, and we're gonna focus in on a story a little bit later that kind of brought this to a head for me.
Okay,
but when you're reading just some of the things that God has said in the Old Testament, you have to ask yourself, if you're like, say, if you're a jealous God,
who are you jealous of?
Like, are you really jealous of like a mountain or melted gold, or really, like, is that right, the God that? So when they talk about worshiping other gods and you see different cultures intermingling or in the Old Testament, each of them have their own gods.
Yes.
And so when you hear things like God is a jealous God, it's not God is a jealous God of your,
because he ain't got nothing PS4
better to do, or whatever. It's God was a jealous God of other gods.
Exactly.
This verse in Deuteronomy 6:4, we're gonna touch this a few times. The verse says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord alone."
Yes.
The Lord is our God, the Lord alone. This is the people of Israel.
Yes.
Saying the Lord is our God, but God alone. The reason why they're saying that is because people in Israel are worshiping other gods than Yahweh.
And they have observed other cultures.
Yes.
Worshipping multiple gods.
Yes. So next door, you got Moab. They have Chemosh, who's a god. You got Milcom, who's the god of the Ammonites. You have Astarte, the god of the Sidonians.
Okay.
Asherah. You got Egyptian gods around. You got all of these other gods. And then you have this nation that's growing amongst all of these other cultures.
Yep.
And they're establishing Yahweh as a god. But that this is not a national effort initially. This is just some people worship Yahweh. Oh, Yahweh's cool. Oh, you worship Chemosh. Oh, that's cool. You worship Astarte. Oh, okay. And people kind of dealt with that. Now, what happens is there's this God that people are pretty familiar with in the Bible, Baal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And
this is the golden calf.
Yes. Okay. So Baal pops up in a few places. And the reason why Baal is so prominent in the Old Testament is because Baal is this god that's worshipped outside of Israel, but also inside of Israel. There's a lot of Baal worship going on, and that's why you'll see later a king who actually takes care of that. But in 1 Kings chapter 18, verses 20 through 40, we're not going to read it because it's 20 verses.
Right.
There's this competition. The prophet Elijah, through some politics, Jezebel's in the story too, but the prophet Elijah is taking God and facing off against the prophets of Baal. And they have this competition in which Yahweh triumphs over Baal. The interesting thing about this story, and this is the story that kind of piqued my interest, there's nothing about this story that indicates that Baal is not a real thing.
Right.
Or that Baal doesn't exist. There's some speculation that this is an alleged account. This account was written centuries after it's supposed to have occurred. But whether it's true or not, what made it into the scriptures is Baal is a god too.
Right.
Here's where all of this starts to come together. Now, Baal, I said, is inside and outside. So this defeat of Baal, we have to start to bring something else closer to our religious ideas or our theology.
Right.
And this defeat is a political defeat. This is Elijah and Israel going against another nation. And it's basically saying our God is better than your God.
Your God.
In this story, who wins?
Yahweh.
Okay. Who's writing the story?
people who like Yahweh.
Okay, so who knows
if that's really what happened. This is actually
how this went down.
Right.
But this is people who are trying to explain, like I said, this is written centuries later, explain how they got the more powerful God. Mm-hmm. Because their God defeated this God, Baal. And this moment is what starts this move from all of these gods as polytheism to monotheism.
Mm-hmm. All right. Come on. We're right there.
So before this, when Baal is in play and doing Baal things, mm-hmm, amongst other gods.
Cranking.
Yeah. So you got all of these ideas, all of these other gods, and they're able to exist. They're able to thrive and, mm-hmm, do whatever. And people. So if you think about like New York.
Okay.
New York City. Huh. New York is probably one of the most religiously diverse cities in this country.
And the world.
Probably in the world.
Yeah.
They have different ideas from all over. They, yes, have mix of ideas. The ideas bump into each other. You have some people who are traditionally evangelical Christian bumping up against some new thought ideas. Mm-hmm. And maybe they sound a little bit like Oprah, who will have Christian ideas, or Yandla, who have Christian ideas, but then also these metaphysical ideas, right, and things like that. You have Muslims in place with Hasidic Jews. And,
yep,
you have just this, that is a heady melting pot mix of, yes, religious ideas. Think about ancient Israel as this type of melting pot.
Mm-hmm.
And so this defeat of Baal now is signifying, okay, I know y'all are thinking all of these things, but we got the God, and our God is going to ride with us.
We willing to put our God up against y'all God.
Okay, so this is going to be a short episode because I'm definitely not going to theology y'all to death. But there's a king that enters into the picture named King Josiah.
Okay.
King Josiah, if you're just reading the Bible, he seems like a champion because he basically gets rid of all of the idols, burns all of the prophets of the other gods, and cleans out Israel in the name of Yahweh. The political element of this should not be lost, that he is building a strong nation. And to do that, you have to clean out the other gods that are there.
Exactly.
Okay, and this is what happens. So King Josiah is not a polytheist. He is also not a monotheist. He's what's called a monolatrist, where he's bringing Yahweh together, but he hasn't got to the point. He hasn't brought them to the point yet where it's just God and God alone.
Okay.
He's
a monolatrist.
I'm worshiping this one God,
mm-hmm,
but I'm not denying these other gods yet because I'm killing these other gods. Like, so I'm getting rid of them.
Right.
In the book, there's a book called The Evolution of God. There's an author who's quoted Baruch Halpern. He believes the various deities who were stigmatized as foreign during Israel's religious reforms had in fact been Yahweh's subordinates in an Israelite pantheon.
Uh-huh.
So in Israel, you have greater and lesser gods, different gods. You have Yahweh of Samaria. You have Yahweh of Teman. You have all of these Yahwehs that people in different areas of Israel are worshiping. There's nothing.
There's no
basically
glue.
The God of this region, or the God of these people.
Okay. So was there no recognition between these different, like if they were calling them the Yahweh of this area and this area?
Mm-hmm. That was their Yahweh. So
their own personal Yahweh.
Yes.
So they didn't think that their Yahweh of the East was the Yahweh of the West.
No. So just think about it, like, this is the God of Maryland, or okay, this is the God of, I don't know.
No, I Brazil. Get what you're saying. That's what I'm getting at. If we call him by the same name, is it not the same God?
Mm-mm.
Okay, go ahead.
That's the God that's for us. People's gods were for them.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're in Samaria and you have all these other people and you're looked at a certain way, you still want a God for yourself. And so you have all these. So now what happens is King Josiah is coming along, and not only is he getting rid of all these other gods, he's trying to consolidate the different Yahwehs.
Right.
So the greater and the lesser and all of this stuff, he's bringing them together under the name of Yahweh. So then if we go back to that Deuteronomy 6 passage, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord alone."
Mm-hmm.
If you break out your Bible and read it, Lord is capitalized. You can substitute Yahweh for Lord because that's what's there.
Mm-hmm.
So then when you read it that way, it says, "Hear, O Israel, Yahweh, our God, is one Yahweh."
Okay.
The reason why it says that is because you have all of these Yahwehs coming together.
And they've made him one God.
It's not all these multiple Yahwehs. There's one Yahweh. You see how we're moving from many gods, not just the gods of other peoples, but the gods within Israel, even the multiple Yahwehs, we're moving into this one God or this monotheism idea. So Josiah's coming through. He's murdering all the priests. He's murdering all the followers of the other gods. He's basically uniting Israel under this one God to ensure this national unity for the nation that he's king of. This is how he strengthens the nation of Israel. And the fact that there are all these other gods around, it reminds me of this movie, the scene from this movie that I really love.
Dear Lord, baby Jesus, we thank you so much for this bountiful harvest of Domino's, KFC, and the always delicious Taco Bell. I just want to take time to say thank you for my family. My two beautiful, beautiful, handsome, striking sons, Walker and Texas Ranger, or TR, as we call them. And, of course, my red-hot smoking wife, Carly, who's a stone-cold fox, who, if you were to rate her ass on 100, it would easily be a 94. Also want to thank you for my best friend and teammate, Cal Naughton Jr., who's got my back no matter what.
Shake and bake.
Dear Lord, baby Jesus, we also thank you for my wife's father, Chip. We hope that you can use your baby Jesus powers to heal him and his horrible leg, and it smells terrible, and the dogs are always bothering with it. Dear tiny infant Jesus.
Hey, you know, sweetie, Jesus did grow up. You don't always have to call him baby. It's a bit odd and off-putting to pray to a baby.
Well, look, I like the Christmas Jesus best, and I'm saying grace. When you say grace, you can say it to grown-up Jesus or teenage Jesus or bearded Jesus or whoever you want.
You know what I want? I want you to do this grace good so that God will let us win tomorrow.
Dear tiny Jesus, you're golden fleece diapers with your tiny little fat balled up fist pawing.
He was a man. He had a beard.
Look, I like the baby version the best. Do you hear me? I win the races and I get the money.
Ricky, finish the damn grace.
I like to picture Jesus in a tuxedo t-shirt because it says, like, I want to be formal, but I'm here to party, too. Because I like to party, so I like my Jesus to party.
I like to picture Jesus as a ninja fighting off evil samurai.
I like to think of Jesus like with giant eagle's wings and singing lead vocals for Lynyrd Skynyrd with like an angel band. And I'm in the front row and I'm hammered drunk.
Hey, Cal, why don't you just shut up?
Yes, ma'am.
Dear 8-pound, 6-ounce newborn infant Jesus, don't even know a word yet, just a little infant, so cuddly, but still omnipotent. We just thank you for all the races I've won and $21.2 million.
Woo!
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 Ow!
Love that money.
So that's what's happening with like Jesus. Like that's how I see it when I'm reading the Bible. Like this is all these people with all these different views of God.
Right.
And like how do you say which one is the right one? Can you say that? Now see, in you know, 21st century, we say, no, there's only one God. It's just God alone. And
I don't know.
Biblical literalism is funny because what do you do with all these other gods? What do you do with the fact that the Old Testament is not presenting?
You put them in time out.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
You pray to, which God do you pray to? Which one is your favorite?
I don't know, because I'm kind of ashamed to say.
which Jesus you pray to? Which, or whoever?
So, I'm not going to front. Some of my prayers sound just like Ricky Bobby. Like, listen, the Jesus that cares about this particular thing is the Jesus that behaves this particular way. And it's cathartic because it makes him relatable to me. I'm going to use these words. I might even be funny because I need you to really like hear the petitions of mine. But I mean, okay. Like, I get it.
There's something comforting about praying to a God that sees you, that recognizes you.
Yes.
And that prayer is so perfect to me because you hear everyone trying to find the God that works for them.
Right. And the God they prefer. This is how I prefer to perceive you.
Jesus is a ninja. So, you know, this centralizing of Jesus into this divine oneness.
Centralizing of God.
Yeah, centralizing of God. Is the creation of this theocracy. mm-hmm. that Josiah is working on.
Right.
And what I want people to understand is that there is not ever a point in your history or our history where this political idea or this political force is not tied to this religious force.
Mm-hmm.
Because you move into a land and they have gods. Even if this was the most technologically advanced, science dependent
society,
there's going to be things that we still take on faith or have faith in.
Yes.
And so those ideas will always come in contact with each other. And it's not possible for your politics to not be influenced by your theology, or your theology to not be influenced by your politics.
Mm-hmm.
So this theocracy that Josiah's building is something that we see like right now in the world.
Right. And it's happened with every major empire. Every nation state has considered how to organize their society. Politics and religion are filters and organizers of people. So what King Josiah has done here is really no different from what other, let's say, ancient cultures have done in the process of building up their ultimate nation state. So like, not everybody would know, but like, you didn't just wake up with the globe as you see it. It is this. It's the local cultures and local groupings of people that keep coming under larger and larger umbrellas. So if you keep coming under larger and larger umbrellas, then you have to find something that unites the people. They're not always your enemy. So it's not always something to be vanquished, destroyed, written away as if it didn't exist. Sometimes you co-opt practices and beliefs into the larger story that you want everybody to buy into. It's how our religions and our customs and our culture spread. So it's not so much that I want to do away with what you're doing. I'm just going to find a way to fit it into ultimately what I want to see happen. So like in building the nation state that ultimately became Greece, you had different gods for different reasons. And we're familiar with a lot of Greek mythology that helped all of these different local tribes, for lack of a better term, to find a common ground, because you used to treat like Athens as its own independent nation. You treated everybody knows Sparta, you know what mm-hmm. I mean, from the 300. You treated it as its own independent nation. And in building up what ultimately became Greece as a Mediterranean power, you had to find a way to give people something in common. So the mythology spread so that people's other gods had a greater role in Greek culture and life. So Zeus, if you will, who was the king of all the gods in Greece, in him being at the top, and you looking at, you know, who else is there? You're looking at, let me see, Athena, Apollo, gods of light, wilderness, war, gods of the harvest, agriculture. You start to rearrange them so that there's space for everybody, but there's this ultimate understanding that Zeus is at the top. When Rome begins to rise as a Mediterranean power, Italy is not a country. This is a collection of these smaller, independent kingdoms, if you will, that when they were seeking to grow together and not necessarily war with one another, but how do we measure our power against other Mediterranean people? They said, oh, we can mimic Greek mythology, give them Roman names, and give them attributes of our culture. Why? Because we're getting ready to go and conquer Greece as a part of what grows to become the Roman Empire. This idea of monotheism uniting or not uniting the people is not new. It actually happened in ancient Egypt. We had a king, Akhenaten, who proposed monotheism to a polytheistic society, disrupting how that society not only worships, but the political ramifications of taking the power from the priesthood, where I could be the priest to the god over the harvest and you don't want to deal with the drought. And then I'm the priest of the god over fertility and you want your women to, you know, to produce children and you want to have a strong people and you want to have more babies or whatever the case may be. Well, when I say that ultimately, the sun god is the only god that we have to worry about worshiping. I've stripped you of your power because I don't have to please you. Now I have to please this one God. And history kind of, I'm not proclaiming to be a expert on this particular piece, but Akhenaten did not rule long enough. And after he died, they brought back the polytheism because it brought back the power of the priesthood class in that society. So him trying to unite behind monotheism push some ideas forward, but it's not something new. It's not something that just develops around the Israelites. If anything, you start looking at how these years line up and you'll realize that it's probable that after 40 years in the wilderness and moving forward, and now Israel gets to be the nation that sees itself closest to God, they have to figure out what to do with all that they've observed versus all that they are trying to know or trying to grow toward. So what King Josiah is doing is necessary because I have to give you one common thing to believe in. We're not a strong enough, deeply rooted enough nation with enough of a track record, if you will, for you to say, oh, no, I rock with Israel because Israel is everything. And this is what it's going to be. We're still dealing with 12 tribes and, you know, whose house is kind of like our Westeros episode, like whose house is the top house in Westeros. So it's the same thing. This idea that if I give you one common thing to believe in, this is what Catholicism was before the Reformation, which was dissent. I mean, it's cool, but I don't believe that this should be this way. And what did they do? It was just like that clip. I like the Jesus that does it this way. Mm-hmm. I like when my God interacts with my family or my day-to-day life or my dreams or my aspirations this way. And it eventually spawns into different sects. They found a way to not disrupt all of Christianity. No. We're not going to mess up the church's money like that. Yeah. But we're just going to build other churches. You want to go through that door? Go ahead. Be Episcopalian. You want to go through this door? Go ahead. Be Kojic. You want to go through this door? Go ahead. Be, you know, AME Zion or AME. But this idea of this ever evolving God alone, it is the absorbing as well as the dispelling of these other, you know, religious theological ideas.
They had to cast the other nations or surrounding nations as the other thing. And you know, these are geopolitical moves or maneuvers. One way you know is because Israel doesn't always win the fights. And whenever the nation goes into battle, they carry their God with them, or their God sometimes goes before them, or their God is with them. So if they lose, the God loses. Mm-hmm. Israel didn't always
win.
Mm-hmm. So every time it's not attributed that God loses, but in 2 Kings chapter 3, God loses because Israel loses. Mm-hmm. And that's why you see this link between the two. Now, this is a very powerful idea that we're going to unify all of these gods. If you think about, let's say in America, in Nebraska, I may need God to be the God of the harvest or the Lord of the harvest. Mm-hmm. In Miami, I may need God to be a God of employment or maybe
ever increased resources.
Sure. Maybe the harvest in the sea.
You're right. Or environmentalism, making sure that we are safe, you know, from natural disaster because of what happens.
Now,
here,
they're not praying to the same God for the same things. The God of the harvest in Nebraska doesn't care about your crab harvest in North Carolina. That they wouldn't pray that crab prayer in Nebraska. So what happens is, like, on September 11th, you get this opportunity to unite everything that's there. And now, no matter what you believe, it's our God.
Right.
God is with us as we go forward together to take care of this other threat that's outside of this nation.
Right.
This is how the geopolitical forces work in conjunction with the religious forces to actually get movement and unite a people to move towards a goal.
Mm-hmm. And it's always, these are not new ideas. It's always been that.
So why does this matter? Why do we, this is really a shorter episode, like I said, because I'm not We're not going to be here all day.
It's so much here. There's no way we could do this a lot. No, well, let me tell you, when we were working on the outline, one of the things that I saw the value in this conversation, one of the reasons why this matters is because, again, as we keep on with the theme of centering yourself and centering your community, your experiences, your inalienable characteristics about your life and your behavior and your personality, there might be some conflict, some tension between, let's say, considering integrating an ancestor affirmation or religious practices that are rooted in different African inspired or directly African rooted practices. And these conversations need to happen because a lot of fear is created behind doing something new when there's no understanding. This is an example of kind of getting all of your gods to play nice together. Right. So if the commandment is that you should have no other God before him, that's fine. But you also have to understand, if you are interested in, I don't want this to be super controversial, but there's space for your ancestor affirmation in continuing to have a Christian identity. And if there is not, I want to say, trust me, and that sounds a little bit too intimate, but trust me that if there is not, it's probably by design, not by declaration.
Yeah.
Does that make sense to
you? So even after King Josiah's efforts, and it was a really valiant effort to unite and ultimately work, not just in his lifetime, but beyond. Even after his effort to bring all of these Yahwehs together and wipe out all these other gods, archaeologists still have found in Israel carvings of other deities, feminine deities and things like that, that people retained. They continued to worship them. So for a conversation like this, it should prompt a few questions, which we're not going to answer for you, but maybe we'll just frame them. Why do we claim monotheism when the Bible does not? If you're looking at the entire arc of the history of Israel in the Old Testament, as it's told in the Old Testament, you know, you cannot, under any form of biblical literalism, claim that Israel only worshipped the one God throughout the history.
No, that'll change the whole Old Testament.
Okay, so when that happens, then does that take anything away from Yahweh if we understand that there were other gods there?
I don't think that takes anything away from. If anything, we're explaining why these scriptures say, listen to me. He's the man. This man that I'm now telling you about, he's the man. Not these lesser men you've been messing with. Like, they cool, but he's the man. Ultimately, this is where we're going to get our direction. This is where we're going to get our, you know, holy scripture from. This is where we're going to get our tenets and our standards of adherence from. Okay.
Yeah, I don't think that there's an issue with having a God that's on your team. Like, who doesn't want or need that? Who doesn't want or need? Well, some people don't, but many people do prefer a God that is looking out for them, that is watching over them and the things that they cannot control. Because whether we're talking about famine and flooding or whether we're talking about
disease, illness, resources.
Yes, resources. Employment and things like that, you still want something helping you with the things that you cannot do for yourself. So, yeah, I don't think it takes away from the God that you should. Just like the Yahweh of Samaria or Taman wasn't anything different before King Josiah brought them all together. They just had someone that was on their team.
Right.
And you want God on your team.
If you're into that sort of thing.
I did have this question here about, is God being the only God something that God claims or something we claim about God? This goes back to who's writing the story.
Right.
So God says certain things depending on who's holding the pen. And if God is the only God, you see a group of Yahwists trying to tell a story or write a convincing narrative about the God that they serve and why that God is
worth serving.
Right. And then this, for me, brings up questions about theocracy as I see a faction in this country moving towards theocracy. Theocracy, I don't envision as just a religious state. It's not just religion. There's also politics. If you look at a theocracy in Saudi Arabia, there's religion, there's Islam, and there's politics. Sudan, religion and politics. It's always the same. So what do we have now? Because we have politics, but we also have religion.
We have a lot of gray areas. But again, I think that looking back gives you so much information about the patterns that can inform you about what direction we're headed in. And when you begin to wield the power of a religious faction on behalf of the government, you're going to run into certain issues, because people tend to treat their elected leaders versus, let's say, their religious leaders at two different standards. So treating our political leaders according to what we think our community level secular needs are is going to be a little bit different than how we entreat our religious leaders, who we sometimes go to with those personal and intimate needs that we wouldn't necessarily go to our senator about. Like, we don't go to our senators and say, I really want to be a better person. I really want to treat my family better. I want to communicate with my parents better. I want to treat my neighbor better. When we do, we're talking about things like, therefore, I want, you know, the streets cleaned up. I want the lights on so we all feel safe. I want our taxes to be low so that, you know, we have a good quality of life. Like, it leads to these outcomes. When you go to your religious leader and you talk about the ideals and the aspirations of yourself, your family, or your community, it's usually about the intangibles. We want to feel better, think better, love better, communicate better, have more compassion. When you begin to mix these things, I can blur the lines that to make you a better person, you have to empower your government to do even more or to have even more say in your life. This could have very, very bad outcomes for people who do not walk that line, that that is the role of their elected leader. That's where we are. That's part of where we are right now in the United States in this particular experiment. Part of the foundation of the experiment was this intentional separation of church and state, even though they have never truly been separate.
They cannot be separated.
Okay.
Because they both deal with how you treat other people, how you interact with other human
beings. Exactly. But one is intentionally secular and the other one is not. Right.
But they both, I think one is lying. I think both may be lying. You can't say that your religion is devoid of politics, because you have politics on every job that you have. You can work at Chick-fil-A, you can work on Wall Street.
Right.
You're always going to have to navigate the politics of that environment. So we know that's in our churches. We know there's church politics.
Mm-hmm.
You can have a political discussion, but undergirding that is going to be values, air quotes.
Beliefs,
yeah. What are those values going to be based on? You want to have some type of common agreement. The quickest route to any common agreement of values that we've seen is some sort of
acknowledgement,
belief undergirding it. And usually religion is the fastest way.
Right.
That
to me is low hanging fruit, though.
How?
In that, we just said this, religion and politics help organize large groups of people so that you can kind of get a healthy sense of where they stand. It's groupthink. But what we're realizing and what we're seeing now is it does not take a lot of critical thought for a person just to declare, you know, their membership in any particular religious group.
Yeah.
What takes critical thought is applying whether or not that membership reflects your personal values and beliefs, your actions, and your standards. That's where your critical thought is. So it's kind of low hanging fruit to say we're all Christian, therefore you should vote this way. That's kind of what we've tried to illuminate in different discussions that we've had that overlap between what you might do in your house of worship versus how your community functions. But it's important because someone is telling a great group of people all that matters is a belief in God.
Yeah.
And this is what your God wants you to do. And people are not questioning when you apply that standard to how you actually live. Do you realize what it's saying about you as a person? Vacating the individual for the group is something that I think let's say, socialists get accused of, because it sounds good. But is that not what the goal might be? Vacating your personal conviction or your personal standard for what you want to see the group be able to do.
Yeah, I agree with you that it's almost like the buy-in to religion is as low as it can be. Like, you don't really have to do anything to say that. I mean, it takes more to get into a gang than it does to get into a religion. Church. Right. Mm-hmm. So, like, how much do you trust the people who are there with you who it cost them nothing to do? So how do I know how you're going to do it? Are you going to change the way that you treat people? Are you going to change these things about your life? Or are you just going to say you in it and do nothing different, do nothing better? And that's part of the beauty of the system, that it doesn't cost much, or it doesn't cost hardly anything to get in. But then the return is commensurate with the investment.
See, we just touched on something right there that we're going to have to explore, because I think that's true. A confession of faith to me is a personal acknowledgement of what you hope to achieve and hope to experience, and also indicative of what you're willing to give to be a member of XYZ religious group. But your confession of faith is not necessarily equal and opposite to your civic participation, right? Because you could be as we say, sold out, okay? You could be sold out for Christ and have not voted in a presidential election or a local election your whole adult life, okay? But just like you gave the example of September 11th, that catalyst of that event became a catalyst of action to people who had previously been inactive on either side. They had been inactive politically, and they got active politically. They had been inactive, you know, with they had a loose-fitting Christian identity, or American Christian identity, and American Judeo-Christian identity. So many different, you know, different hyphens came into play. But what most people marveled at is that that event was a catalyst for people to vacate their hyphens and be Americans for however long it lasted.
Yeah.
It was amazing to experience as somebody who's, you know, originally from New York City. Visiting New York after that incident, I was like, where am I? People were intentionally nicer. It's almost like they were responding to the stereotype that of the rough New Yorker, right? The rough talking, rough behaving, don't care about your feelings New Yorker. I don't believe that. That's not the New York that, even if it has those sides, that is not the New York that I've experienced. And it's a gritty place. So gritty places produce, you know, hard people. That
wears Tims
all the time. That being said, I will not go for your slander. That being said, they're some of the most loving people that I know, yet and still this event happens, you know, in their backyard, in their hometown. And how the locals dealt with it versus how the greater America dealt with it, two totally different things. But it was a political catalyst for federal movements. Y'all, I was just ready to go there. People gave up their personal privacy after September 11th because their feelings got hurt.
Yep.
Something that wouldn't have ever passed muster without that catalyst. Without that, you don't have a Patriot Act. You don't have some of the movements that were made legislatively that continue to affect us today. And we have a whole bumper crop of kids now who are going to come of age and become adults after this event has happened, who only know their country as this.
Wow. I hadn't even thought of that. Yeah.
Yeah. That's kind of the stuff I be doing over here. So we have to continue. I mean, we touch on things, we ask questions, but this right here has deeper implications because it's a part of empire building. You can't have an empire where, I call it the wisdom of the grandmother, just like you just said, even as these monotheistic ideas spread, you would still find archaeologists discovering tchotchkes of old practices. That's grandmother's wisdom. I don't care what they saying. Listen, you better pray to this fertility goddess. Mm-hmm. You try to have these kids. It worked for me. It worked for you. That these are things that are passed word of mouth, because she's not your king. She's your grandmother.
Yeah.
The level of trust that you have with her is going to be different. Things will come up where you will not have access to your king. You don't have no memories of your king or of your queen, but you have memories of your matriarch. This is going to be the difference between I'm book smart or I'm street smart.
Yeah.
Right? It's the same kind of idea. So every empire, when they have come bumped up against these lands where I don't really know what y'all be doing, but I swear y'all the best farmers. Let me tell y'all about how y'all farming God, y'all agriculture God, mm-hmm. really rocks with my bigger God, right? Because I could kill all of y'all, but then who's going to feed us? Mm. So I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to talk real nice to you and say, and wouldn't you know it, my God actually thinks your God is really cool, and your God thinks my God is worth worshiping, mm. right? So before we kill y'all and just take this harvest, why don't we just work together? That's how you build an empire. You can't kill. You catch more flies with honey than with vinegar, mm-hmm. right? So imagine the opposite. We have the largest food stores and there's a famine in the land. This is a perfect opportunity for me to get your army, my God, that keeps us fed. Y'all over there hungry? He thinks y'all are great. And if y'all will work with us, we'll feed you. But that army belongs to me.
That is exactly what has happened. Oh, Lord. Okay, that's a different show.
Okay,
I mean, it's
so
actually this show, but we said we're going to be short. And we are the same length as we always are. So
thanks for hanging out.
Yes, for Faith Uncut, I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
For more on Faith Uncut, check us out at faithuncut.com.